I'm Barbara Barry, and you're listening to Gilbert Gottfried's amazing, colossal podcast.
Excellent.
Too much acting?
Love it.
No,
I like
play?
The acting.
This is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre, and we're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer Frank Verderosa. We're especially excited to be joined by our guest this week. He's a singer, songwriter, record producer, and one of the most inventive and influential keyboard players in the history of pop music. He's also a member of the Songwriters Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and one of the leading voices of the rock generation. As one of the founders and the lead singer of the wildly popular rock quartet, The Rascals, he sold millions of records and recorded the hit songs A Girl Like You, It's a Beautiful Morning, How Can I Be Sure, and number one singles like People Got to Be Free, Groovin', and of course, Good Lovin'. Voted one of Rolling Stone magazine's greatest songs of all time. In a career spanning 7 decades, he's worked and performed with celebrated musicians such as Billy Joel, Tom Jones, Todd Rundgren, Jimi Hendrix, Bing Crosby, Billy Preston, Laura Nero, former podcast guest Tommy James, Paul Schaefer, Jimmy Webb, and Howard Kalin, and 4 guys from Liverpool who I think their name is The Beatles. After 50-plus years in the music business, he's still entertaining audiences with his band, Felix Cavalieri's Rascals, with upcoming dates in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York. Welcome to the show, a genuine rock and roll legend, and perhaps most importantly, a man who shares our love of soupy sales. Felix.
How true. How cool. Bravo, bravo, bravo.
Felix Cavalieri.
Thank you, thank you.
Felix.
Great. Felix.
Stop leaving little notes on my pillow. I told you a million times, I don't want little notes on my pillow.
Sorry about that.
Yes. Oh.
Felix, welcome.
Thank you, thank you. I guess you all know Soupy, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Gilbert knew him. I didn't have the pleasure.
Oh, man. What a great guy.
Yeah, he was a nut, Soupy.
Great guy.
He was great.
Great guy.
And now I have to ask you, but I remember the rumor used to be that the reason the band was called The Rascals is because you're one of the little rascals grown up. So, were you alfalfa or something?
Yeah. Well, the reason the band was called The Rascals was because of Soupy. I don't know if you know that story.
Oh, tell us.
I will certainly tell you. You know, yeah. We were trying to be discovered. And Soupy, of course, was a WNEW TV. And, you know, he happened to have a couple of hit records. He had this thing called The Mouse.
Of course.
Yes.
So we got this great idea. We said, let's go down there and see if he'll accept us as a backup band. We can go out on the road with him. So we go into the station, you know, and immediately, you know, he started, you know, telling jokes, you know, he said like, okay, everybody hold your wallets. You know what I mean? These guys don't look too good, you know? And we started laughing. And so we told him, we said, well, Soupy, you know, we know you have some hit records now, Bahalafika, and you need a band. And he says, you mean all these years I've been without a band. I didn't realize that I needed a band. And we started laughing again. He says, you know, this could work. Because sometimes I work, nobody laughs. At least I know you guys are going to laugh, right? So we said, what do you call yourselves? And we really didn't have a name. We kept looking for names, you know. We kept looking around for, you know, we had some ideas. So he said, what I'd like to call you, we can't print.
I wonder what that was.
And I swear, I think he came up with this name, The Rascals, you know. And later years, of course, you know, our manager surprised us with an adjective, you know. He says, we got to put the young in there, you know. And why? Because somebody, I don't know if you guys remember the Milton Berle show, the Harmonica Rascals,
yeah.
Oh,
that's,
yes.
That's way back.
Yeah, sure.
He said, we're going to get sued. I said, but young? Couldn't you put like yellow or anything? You know, that's young.
Yellow Rascals.
And, you know, that was a really interesting thing for us because for years, people would come up to me and say, did that dog really have a circle around his eye or did they paint that?
They thought you were one of the Rascals.
You remember that, though, I see.
Oh, absolutely.
You guys know.
Yeah, Petey.
You guys know, see?
Yeah.
And the real Alfalfa was, I think, shot.
I think he was stabbed. I think he was stabbed in a bar.
Someone owed him money.
Yeah, it was a dispute over a dog, I think.
Yeah, and yeah, he was stabbed to death in a bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
Where did the costumes come from, Felix? The whole Little Lord Fauntleroy stuff.
Well, see, I blame Dino, the drummer, for
Dino
that.
Dino Danelli?
He won't take the credit for that, but yeah, I mean, well, basically, you know, we had to wear suit and tie in those days to work in clubs because it was 21 and over. So we tried to find an excuse, you know, a way around that. And unfortunately, they said, well, that's okay, but you still have to wear a tie. So we abandoned that idea as soon as we could.
So,
believe me.
So, because a lot of people thought, well, like those knickers must have been like a record label's idea.
No, we didn't have a record label yet. We just, you know, had some bad ideas.
You know, AC/DC did the schoolboy outfit thing years later. You guys were ahead of that.
I know.
You're ahead of that curve.
Now,
yeah, we just wanted to get out of the suits, you know.
Now, I remember when I was a kid, my mother bought me a 45, and on one side, the A side was the Mouse, the B side was Pafalafika.
That's right.
Now,
that's it.
Now, on Skype, it's almost impossible to do, but Can me and Felix Cavallari sing a duet of the Mouse?
Well, you'd have to sing different sections of it.
I don't remember the Mouse, I'm sorry to say, but I don't remember it. I know it was Do the Mouse. That's all I remember.
Well, give him a little bit.
Hey, Do the Mouse, yeah. Hey. Do it all around your house, yeah.
Oh, my
In
God,
the
yes.
rug or on the wall. If your folks get bugged, do it in the hall. Do the mouse, yeah. Let's do the mouse. Come on, let's do the mouse with me.
See, I'm glad I forgot that one.
Yes. And Pafalafika was Pafalafika. Pafalafika, it sounds so romantic and perky.
Yes,
Pafalafika, Pafalafika, it sounds so romantic and turkey.
Yep. And you know, he was right because many times we worked with him and we were the only ones laughing.
You know, I got to tell you, Felix, Howard Kalin loves Soupy, too, and we talked to him. But he said Soupy had incredible pot. Does that...
he was just... he was a doll.
Really?
No, he was just such a sweet man, you know. God bless him, man. I miss him. You know, he was a really great guy, you know. We miss him.
Soupy was one of those guys, when I'd run into him, he would always have, like, a bunch of the stupidest jokes you've ever heard. It would always crack you up.
Yeah. Yep. Good man. Good people.
Now, he never hit you with a pie, though, did he?
No, no. Oh, no, absolutely.
That
no, we're too short. He couldn't hit. He couldn't find us.
Yeah. Felix, we got a kick out of finding out, and we do deep research for this show, and we get a, I thought I knew all there was to know about you. I didn't know you were pre-med.
Oh, yeah.
Which is fascinating.
Absolutely.
You're a local boy here from Pelham.
Yeah. Yeah, my whole family was in medicine, you know, and then I shocked them, you know. Yeah, I had no idea I was going to be in music. The only thing I knew is that, you know, my mom, rest her soul, she had me taking classical music at a very early age, you know, and I didn't really want to do that because I couldn't create, you know. I had to play what was written. But then I went to college. I went to Syracuse, and I, as a matter of fact, I was up there with Lou Reed. We were in the same year. And, you know, just like that's what somebody wanted me to do, I guess, so that's what I did.
So now, if your parents had been Jews, and
instead of, he's one of mine, by the way. He's Italiano.
And you were to say to them, no, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a big rock and roll star.
Right.
They would have fucking killed you.
You got that right.
Yes. So how did...
Well, it's the same thing in the Italian family.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Pretty much.
Well, you know, basically what happened is I got a job in my junior year through some of our fraternity people in the Catskills, the good old Catskills. Now, I'm sure you must have worked at Catskills.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I loved it. I just, oh, my God. I was making $60 a week. And room and board. And
what were you doing? Like, were you playing backup for a?
We were the kind of like the swing band.
Swing band.
And by that, what I mean is we did everything. We played for the guests when they came in, cocktail hour. We played for the teens in the teen room, and then at night we played for the lounge because the twist was happening. That's how friggin' long ago this was. So in comes this group because the stars, the headliners of the week would come in, Joey D and the Starliners.
Oh, sure.
And they saw me, and, you know, make a long story short, they remembered me when they went to Europe because their organ player quit on them, so they needed a substitute. Now, meanwhile, the story, as I said, I don't want to take up all your time with the story, but there was this maitre d' there at that hotel that, you know, he saw me getting ready to go back to college, you know, in September, August there. And he told me, he says, man, you should do this. You're good. You should do it. So when my father, the doctor, comes into the Catskills, he said, don't worry. I'll take care of your father. Don't worry. He treated him like I was Elvis. Now, remember, I'm making $60 a week here. You know what I'm saying? So I was a real big shot, you know? But my dad was like flabbergasted. He says, you're doing pretty well here. I says, yeah, man. Oh, absolutely. So when I hit him with, can I take a year off? It's like butter.
Wow.
Yeah. And he let me go. You know, he said, take a shot, you know.
And what comedians did you see out in the Catskills?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we had the good pleasure of seeing a lot of the real famous guys, you know, like Jackie Mason was up there, you know, and... Oh, I'm trying to think of some of the names. You probably know the names better than I, but some of the classic guys. I mean, you just don't find these guys anymore, you know. And, you know, I didn't realize how nasty some of those guys could be.
Gilbert, you only played the Catskills, what, that one time? Was it Browns or like, Kutcher's? Or?
Yeah, I was at the Neverly.
Oh, the Neverly. You did the Neverly.
Yeah.
Oh,
the,
yes.
The owners and the band liked me.
Yes,
that
gotcha.
Was about it.
But those were great days. I mean, you know, and you know, I got a lot of experience up there. I mean, some good, some bad, but we were at the Raleigh, you know, and it was just, you know, like something that I don't know if this generation even knows what we're talking about, but, you know, it was magic. You know, there's no doubt about it because, you know, Jews have a good time. They go up there, they rock and roll, man. They let it go.
It's a lost era.
It's a lost era.
Yeah,
exactly.
We had some woman...
Yeah.
Who wrote a whole book.
Marissa Scheinfeld.
Yeah.
Yeah, she wrote a book about the. We'll send you a copy. It's fascinating. It's about...
About the Catskills?
Well, it's a photo book about the photo essays of really modern-day photos of what's left. It's actually kind of sad. and tragic. But on the opposite side of the page in the book, you see what the hotel used to look like and what the pool looked like. And it's haunting.
Yeah. Myron Cohen, I remember him.
Oh, Myron Cohen. Great. He was funny.
These are geniuses. These guys, you know, they just got that gift, you know, that, of course, Henny Youngman, you know, he was a very dear friend of our manager, you know, so we got to know him, you know, and Alan King.
Oh.
You know, Alan King. Giants. You know, I'm so proud to have known these guys, you know, because, you know, most of them are just really like brilliant, genius talent. Let's face it. We don't have them like this anymore. They're not like that anymore. They got to use, you know, tricks to get laughs, you know?
Yeah, those guys used to be hysterical.
Oh, just phenomenal.
Henny would kill me.
Oh, funny guy.
You got the right word there, because once they start, you know, you're like that too. Once you get somebody laughing, you don't let them up for air.
Yeah.
You know,
that's it.
It's true.
And now while Gilbert heads into the Nutmeg Kitchen to steal more Perrier, a word from our sponsor.
Gil and Frank went out to pee. Now they're back so they can be on their amazing colossal podcast.
Kids, time to get back to Gilbert and Frank's amazing colossal podcast. So let's go.
So, Felix, how'd you get out of the Catskills and find yourself? I mean, I know it's a journey, but how did you find yourself in Sweden and Germany with the Beatles?
Well, that's
I'm
because
skipping
Joey
a couple
D
of steps there.
Yeah, Joey D hired
Joey
me
D and the Starlighters,
there.
Right?
Yeah, and we go over there, and next thing I know, these guys called the Beatles, who nobody knew yet over here, were opening for Joey D. You know, and so here I'm in a kind of like a decision-making time, like, well, should I try this for him? And I see all these young, beautiful girls screaming, hollering the top of their lungs over these bands. I said, this looks like I could do this. I think I'm going to try this. This looks like fun. And it was really interesting because I remember hearing them for the first time, what I could hear with this, you know, the yelling. And I thought they were primarily a vocal group. You know, I didn't really think, you know, I wasn't that crazy about their musicianship because they were white, you know, and so they played American music. It was kind of like, you know, stiff until they played their songs. When they started playing their songs is when I really, you know, took notice. I said, man, how cool is that? Of course, the next thing you know, the entire world was saying that, you know.
So even back then, girls were screaming by the Beatles?
They could scream from birth. They could scream. Yes.
Yeah.
They did this. It was unbelievable. There was something very special, you know, obviously going on.
Now, here's a question I always ask people who saw the Beatles back then. And I mean, of course, George Martin was a genius. Now, do you think the Beatles would have been as popular without George Martin?
Well, popular is an interesting word. I think they were popular as soon as they went on a stage, frankly.
There
was a certain kind of magic that these guys had that, you know, you can't manufacture. That's the real thing. You know what I'm saying? Now, whether they would have made such phenomenal music without George, you know, we had the same kind of situation with Arif Mardin, rest his soul. You know what I mean?
Genius.
You know, You got to have help, you know. But I mean, I still think popularity. I mean, the people just loved, they adored them.
Wow!
Did you guys socialize? Yeah. Did you have time to hang out with them?
Yeah, It's hard to hang around with gods, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I got to know George a little bit, you know, and
later you would tour with Ringo. Later in your career.
I got to know Ringo a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
But I one time I asked George, you know, I says, hey, George, do you realize that, you know, when you guys like move your little finger, you know, the earth vibrates a little bit, you know? And very deeply and solemnly, he said, yes. So those guys had to carry that burden around wherever they went. Whenever they said something, it was really an important, you know, thing, you know?
It's fascinating.
Interesting fellas and talent. I mean, you know, you can't even talk about how good those guys were.
But they emboldened you, didn't they, Felix? I mean, you've said how you kind of got inspired to, you knew it was about singing and putting your own band together. you didn't want to be doing the peppermint twist, and you didn't want to be doing that kind of stuff the rest of your career.
No, I really felt I could do what they were doing. Of course, I didn't realize the extent of, you know, like the genius that was there. Nobody did at that time, but mm-hmm. I said, hey man, I can handle this. I could do this, you know. And later years, you know, the impact that those guys had on our musicians, you know, for example, when they wrote a song and did a song, the radio stations had to play it.
Mm-hmm.
So when they opened the door, you know, such as Michelle or Yesterday, we walked in the door with How Can I Be Sure?
How can I be sure in a world that's constantly changing? How can I be sure where I stand with you? Whenever I'm away from you, I wanna die. Cause you know I wanna stay with you. How do I know? Maybe you're trying to use me. Flying too high can confuse me. Touch me, but don't take me down.
See, because radio stations, they didn't really want to play that stuff. They had to play that stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
opened the door for all of us.
Yeah.
And I remember, well, it was like Murray the K.
Oh, yeah.
Was a big speaker for the Beatles. And they started calling him the fifth Beatles.
Yeah, one of many fifth Beatles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I'd be remiss as an interviewer if I didn't ask you this question. As a big rock star, were you getting a lot of pussy?
Well, let's put it like this, okay? My nickname was the father of our country. I'll leave it at that. Yeah, that was my nickname inside the band.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
So you came back to the States. You decided I'm going to put a band together.
And well, at first I had a little problem.
Oh, you had the military issue.
Thank you.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Well, what happened? Do you want to tell us?
Yes. They were scared to death of me. They didn't want anything to do with me.
The military.
Yeah, in those days, they were a little bit more kind of like, you know, choosy mm-hmm. about who they put a uniform on.
Uh-huh.
You know, they said, this guy? I don't know, you know. So I said, yeah, you know, it's a long story, but I was not fit for the Army.
I see.
Which was fine. It was one why. And the why is... Why is this guy coming in here? Because you asked me. That's why, you know. And so then I felt free, seriously, to start a band. Because prior to that, you know, I knew I was going to get drafted. And, you know, we had to go through that times, the four of us, each person. It was really, really, really interesting times. There's no question about that.
And you knew you needed singers. Do I have that right? You didn't want guys that were great musicians. You wanted singers.
I wanted great singers. And I wanted great players. And I mm-hmm. said, you know, I want to put the best guys I can find. And, you know, I'm very proud to say that when I found these guys, you know, we had a deal in 6 months.
Yeah.
6 months. We were ready to go.
And you knew Jimi Hendrix.
Right. Yes. I'm happy to say.
Yeah. So how did you get to know Jimi Hendrix? And
well,
what was he like?
Well, first of all, Jimmy was involved in the New York music scene. Way back when, I think he worked with the Isleys, you know, Isley Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a really, really shy guy. I mean, if you can believe that, you know, he was kind of tall, but you never knew it because he was always hunched over. You know what I mean? He was always hunched over. And then in later years, of course, when he went to England, and I don't know if you guys know that story, but that's a fascinating story about when Jimi Hendrix went to England and all these famous star guitar legend said, holy shit, did you see this guy down at the club? He's doing all of us put together. They flipped. And he came back to the United States and did his first solo show as The Experience with us in Madison, in Central Park.
Wow.
So I hadn't seen him, you know, in years. And here's this guy standing upright with a feather in his hat. And I said, man, what happened to you, bro? And he said, I'm going to show you. Well, when there's Rascal fans out there, when he went on the stage, man, he scared them half to death. he was on fire, man. I mean, he just blasted that out there like you can't believe. And, you know, the thing is, man, he was really a nice man. He was really nothing like, you know, you would think of, you know, he was. He was, as a matter of fact, a little bit too nice, you know, because he would give stuff away and sign a lot of contracts and give a lot of money and stuff like that. And then, unfortunately, you know, it caught up to him.
I've heard you say he kind of fell in with the wrong crowd.
Well, you know, a lot of people did because all the folks who were around him have all passed as well. But Jimmy was a very troubled guy because, you know, it's tough to be the best guitar player in the world every night of your life. You know, that's a big, big hill to climb, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I never had to worry about that. Yes.
And Jimi Hendrix also opened for the Monkees.
He did his first tour, I think, with them. Yeah,
he did. And I heard he failed miserably as their opening act.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't see how it's possible. But, you know, as I say, I mean, when he went on stage, it was kind of like nobody was doing that, what he was doing. You know, mm-hmm. they were. However, you know, it's interesting because coming up the way I came up, you know, through the New York club scene, a lot of the people who would come up from the South, you know, and play guitar did a lot of the stuff he did, you know, behind the back and with his teeth and all that. But nobody ever saw that before because it was all obscure, you know what I'm saying? So when he brought that to real life, he also brought it with some of the most fantastic, you know, guitar chops you could get. You know, he really illustrated that. He really brought that into a, you know, kind of a, like a more dynamic vision, you know.
It's so envious that we never got to see these guys play live. Never got to see Hendrix play live or hear that music live.
You can see that, you know, the videos. Of
sure,
him,
sure.
You know, yeah, because he was just a good man. And you know, we had the same attorney, you know, and, you know, really, really tried to help him out, you know, get over those drug things, you know.
Let's talk a little bit Rascal's history too about putting the band together. I thought the way you found Dino through your wife, I think, is an interesting story.
Yeah, well, I was seeing this lady, and you know,
your first wife.
Yeah, she used to go to clubs and stuff like that, and I thought I had a pretty, you know, good idea of some band. And she said, "You guys are all right." I said, "What are you talking about? You're a freaking teller in a bank. Give me a break." She says, "Well, she says, I know a guy." And I says, "Really? Yeah, where?" And you know, I don't know if you guys remember the Metropole. You remember the Metropole?
Oh.
The Metropole was on 7th Avenue, and it had a window. And before they turned to stripping.
Oh, it was like a go-go club.
I remember the Metropole, of course.
Of course you do.
It was a go-go club, right?
In fact, what I remember about the Metropole, when it was a strip club, of course, I knew, like, when you walked down that block at a certain angle, you could look in the door and see a naked girl.
Is that the place that Oscar Madison's looking in the window
I
in the opening of The Odd Couple?
I think so. Yeah. And I remember I used to know exactly what position to be in where you could see inside the Metropole.
Of course you did.
And see a naked girl dancing on the table.
See, that takes talent. That takes talent.
He's a scout.
Yes. Well, prior to the naked woman, they used to have musicians in there, and she took me there, you know, and I saw this guy playing through the window, you know what I mean? And he was like watching a movie, you know, he had learned from guys like Louis Belson and Gene Krupa and these guys how to put on a show as well as play the drums and play them well. And I don't think anybody was doing that at the time, you know, but it was really great seeing that, and so I asked her immediately, "Do you know a guitar player?" You know, because she was certainly right about the drums.
She turned out to be.
And not to interrupt you, but after years of peeking in the Metro, finally I realized I'd gotten some notoriety in show business when the bouncer saw me walking down the street and said, "Hey, come in for free."
You knew you made it.
Yes, yes.
I'm sorry he didn't say, "Don't I know you?"
The Pussycat Lounge.
I've been here for like 300 times. Yeah, it's time to come in. Right? Yeah. The Metropole.
So you put the band together, the Brigatti right. Brothers. You met you met Gene. It just came together piece by piece, right?
Well, Eddie and Gene were working in a club with Joey D mm-hmm. owned called the Starlighter. Mm-hmm. You know, David was not really with us. He came on to sing with some of the records.
Right, the fifth Rascal I heard of.
Correct, like something. Him and Murray. Yeah, right. exactly. But you know, the four of us was Gene, myself, Dino, and Eddie. We started out, and you know, we started out in New Jersey, and then we went to the Barge in Long Island, where we were kind of discovered.
Yeah,
you know, and then Sid Bernstein came and saw us. He came he was asked to come there by another gentleman who wanted to manage us, and then we had a deal almost immediately after that
with Atlantic. Yeah, and you were very proud of the fact that you were the first white act on Atlantic, because they had Ray Charles, they had all these people.
Well, half my collection,
Coasters,
you know,
the Drifters
collection was all friggin', you know, Atlantic. But the main thing about Atlantic is that they allowed us to produce ourselves. I wanted to produce the band. I didn't want to get, you know, somebody to take over the reins. I wanted to do it ourselves, you know, and they were the only ones really that would allow us to do that.
And Ink and Eat My Heart Out was the first single?
Well, yeah, because again, we had not really made a transition to being writers yet, you mm-hmm. know, and so they brought this song, and you know, it was the first time we got on the radio, which was really, you know, pretty cool. It was a lot.
Yeah, we've asked that question when we had Tommy James and we had Howard. We said, what was it like to hear your voice coming out of a? I assume it was a transistor radio. The
right.
first time, a life changing experience.
It was, and it is.
Wow.
You hear yourself, you're walking through a supermarket, you know, and you're hearing groove and you're going like, these suckers, they don't know that's me up there.
That's great.
That's me, man.
That's great.
And you go around smiling and they say, what's wrong with this cat? You know? Yeah, it's a thrill.
What about when you hear a Muzak version of your song?
I've always wondered that.
Well, you know, you got to understand this is a business.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
So there's change being presented at that point. So, you know, we appreciate the change. We appreciate the, you know, we appreciate that. That's about it. Yeah.
Yeah, the checks still come.
The checks come. Yeah. Like I say.
Yeah. So they wanted covers. I've heard you say that the record companies, they wanted covers at that time. They didn't want originals.
Clubs wanted covers. They didn't want to hear, you know, your innermost emotions. They weren't interested. You know, I tell this on stage, you know, like the club owners would come up to me, you know, and they say, listen, I want to explain to you exactly what makes a good band. I said, okay, I can't wait to hear this from my friend that owns this place called the Choo Choo Club, right? He says, you see those people out there dancing? I said, yeah. He says, the next thing they're going to do is start drinking, right? He says, yeah. He says, that's what makes a good band. I says, got it. I got it. So the idea is keep them dancing. That's it. They gets hot. They start drinking. You're good.
Right.
Got the message.
So you're still not writing your own compositions yet with Eddie, but how did you were doing covers, but you were trying to find obscure covers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's how I found a lot of good stuff. Yeah.
And that's how you found Good Lovin'.
That's how I found Good Lovin'. Yeah. Yeah.
By the Olympics.
Well, yes, by the Olympics, and I heard it on you know, a radio station, so it was legit. I went out and bought a copy, showed it to the club owner, and said, look, this is a cover. I can prove it. Here's the original. Ha ha.
Yeah.
And it worked. It worked from the first day.
I watched a video of it, and there's Billy Preston playing keyboards.
Yeah, you know, for the first day we played that song, people, you know, like, they just got up and danced, you know?
Yeah. Well, I prefer your version. Their version is interesting, but it doesn't move like your version. It doesn't
they don't have Dino on the drums. They don't have Mr. Dino kicking butt behind you, you know?
It doesn't have the sound. I'll play them for Gilbert, too, because I think he'd be curious. It doesn't have the same energy as what you guys brought
absolutely,
to it.
Absolutely. 1, 2, 3. Before Good Lovin' became a hit, in those days, you had to go to the West Coast. You had to tie the whole country together radio-wise. So we went out to the West Coast to the Whiskey A Go-Go, and that's really where
you know,
it happened. Now, we're working with guys out there that were in a complete daze. I'm serious. Like, we work with a group. They're in a complete fog. You know, the drugs out there were so thick, you could actually cut it. You know? There was a group, I think it was called Arthur Lee and Love or something like that. I thought they had passed away. They were the opening act. Seriously. So we go on. We got these four kids from New York and New Jersey. They kicked butt from the first minute. You know, it was like a hurricane coming through the room. You know, it was East Coast versus West Coast. Very interesting, man. Never forget that.
Tell us about the creative environment at Atlantic that you started to talk about with Tom Dowd, with Arif, with the guys that created this environment for you guys that was just ideal.
Well, you know, the studio that is unfortunately no longer there.
Yeah.
The history of that studio in terms of what music transpired in that room was absolutely amazing. Between John Coltrane, Ray Charles, the Drifters, you know, all these phenomenal talent. I mean, the Coasters, you know, Phil Spector worked in there. You know, he did Benny King, you know,
yeah,
and all these
sure.
guys. The one thing I got to say about Atlantic, and, you know, I was a pretty naive guy, you know, like I at that point. But as I say, you know, I was really in love with where I was and what I was doing. And I really felt that Atlantic, their number one priority was making great music. And I still believe that. The procedure that they kind of taught us to record was kind of in the jazz vein where, you know, you have a moment in time that you record. You know what I'm saying? There wasn't like, we had only 8 tracks and we were the only ones with 8 tracks, believe it or not. Everybody else had 4. So there was not a lot of overdubs like there are today. So you had to capture a moment and, you know, make it really great. So, you know, I learned so much from those guys, you know, and just enjoyed every moment of it because it was all about music. And I know the people, they wanted to make money. I understand that, you know. But Ahmet and those guys there, Wexler and all those guys, their number one priority was music. And I always will be grateful for that.
And we heard a lot of stories from musicians about, like, the unsung heroes of studio musicians.
Right.
Now, do you have any stories like that, people, or just what you notice with studio guys?
Well, in our case, we were self-contained, yeah, with the exception of the bass. You know, we had a bass player come in from King Curtis's band by the name of Chuck Rainey to begin with. But, you know, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I live in Nashville right now, you know, and I had dinner the other night with a guy by the name of Reggie Young. Now, you probably don't know his name.
We don't.
Google his name.
Okay.
And look at the records that this guy played on. You will not believe. He played with Elvis.
Oh, wow.
He played with, you know, that wonderful song that BJ had, Hooked on a Feeling.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the beginning of Drift Away? Drift Away.
Oh, Dobie Gray.
That's Reggie Young.
Oh, love that.
Now, here's a guy who, you know, nobody knows his friggin' name. He played on over 150 hit records.
He's not in that movie. He's not in Standing in the Shadows of Motown, is he? Or
no,
any of those
wasn't
docs?
No, he was in Motown.
Okay.
He was out of Memphis, you know.
Okay, out of Memphis.
But, I mean, there's a perfect example of what you're saying. I mean, these guys, you know, nobody knows their name. They got session fees and they went home. But, I mean,
right,
without that beginning and those songs, there's no songs. He played on Suspicious Minds,
wow,
you know, for Elvis. So anyway, I was with these guys last night from the Crickets. You remember the Crickets?
Of course,
Buddy Holly's guys?
Of course.
And Reggie. And I told them, man, you guys, these stories are phenomenal. So the drummer from I shouldn't say it on the air because I don't want to give the guy's title away, but I was telling Kim here, I said, you guys got to write a book. So the drummer says, I am writing a book. He says, you know what I call it? I said, what? No shit. I said, wait a second. Where'd you get that title from? He says, every time I tell somebody a story, they go, no shit.
That's so funny.
Is that great?
That's great. You know both those documentaries that I just mentioned, Felix, Standing in the Shadows of Motown, and also the Wrecking Crew doc.
Yes.
Really shine a light on those guys.
Absolutely so should.
People should rent those. Our listeners should rent both of those documentaries. And I saw you in the Arif documentary, by the way.
Oh yeah,
which is
absolutely
very good.
Yeah, he was a great man. I really really miss him.
And talent. I mean, not only working with obviously Aretha and you guys, and I mean they say gave the Bee Gees their sound, but jazz. I mean the guy ran the gamut.
Well, I'll tell you something, you know, like he was
his talent.
Very, very talented guy. And the interesting thing about him is that how he was discovered. And basically he was in Turkey.
Yeah, he's Turkish. Yeah.
And Quincy Jones was appearing in Istanbul. And you know how he used to give, in the old days, they used to give people cassettes. So before Quincy got on the plane and went to the airport or whatever, Arif gave him his cassette. When he got off the plane, he called him up and asked him to come to Berkeley to be a professor. That's how good it was.
Wow.
That's how he got discovered. Now, this guy was a giant, you know, and it's really an interesting story because, you know, when we got there, he was just an A&R guy. He was a guy on staff, you know.
You've said he was your George Martin.
He was a lot of people's George Martin. This guy was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I miss him terribly. He was a great guy. Great guy.
And the Rascals worked with Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
In a special. Yeah, we love that.
And a rowboat. We're on a friggin' rowboat with Bing Crosby.
Was that a pinch me moment for the kid from the Bronx?
You know, there's a lot of pinch me moments.
I'll bet.
It was interesting, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know, like it's just you got to meet all these guys, you know. Like recently I had a major shock. Because I got to know Bill O'Reilly, you know?
Oh.
He loves music. He loves music, this guy. He loves music. Little did I know he was paying off people like that. I should have asked him for some money, you know? It's true.
Were you
great guys. Who knows?
Were you guys, and I love this too, you were the kind of guys, you said you love what you were doing, but you guys would stay in the studio all night sometimes.
Yes.
You were so locked in those days. And the story about Otis Redding, is that apocryphal? That Otis Redding popped his head into the studio?
Oh, yeah,
tell Gilbert,
yeah.
It's so fascinating.
Well, you know, first of all, in answer to the first part of it, Atlantic gave us free studio time. And we took advantage of that, you know, because as long as we were making hit records, and, you know, Wilson Pickett used to get really angry. Man, I can't get in there, man. Them damn Rascals always in that room. Always in that room. But Atlantic had a different kind of environment from, you know, like, for example, Columbia, which we went to later years. It was really a wide open kind of place. You know, there was no signs up recording, do not enter, you know. It was wide open. So Otis, you know, came in, you know, and that's a true story. He opened up the door and he said, my God, they are white.
I love that.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
He used to call Amit
Omelette. Omelette. What's
that? Omelette.
You know, you just reminded me, and now it's weird to have him as a fan, but Bill O'Reilly came up to me at a Saturday Night Live party and told me he was a fan of mine.
See?
And also, I didn't know how to react to that.
Well, I didn't know how to react to it either. You know, he was the nicest guy. He was the sweetest guy. I mean, he came back. I met him at a U2 concert first. And then he came to three or four of my shows. He's a doll. Of course, you know, I'll probably get letters. You know, like,
oh, yes.
He was really sweet, man. I mean, I don't know. Like I say, it's a shame, you know, because there's two sides to every guy.
What were the details about the Bing Crosby show that you guys did and how you wound up in a rowboat?
And
what
did,
it was
And did you ever see Bing beat any of his kids?
Yeah. No, it was some sort of like, it was either an Andy Williams special.
Oh, you did that too?
Yeah. We did that too, yeah. And we were in a boat. I just remember we were in California, you know. Yeah, he was nice. He was a nice guy. He was a little old. You know?
Do you remember doing Hullabaloo with Alan King in 1965?
Oh, yeah. Sure, sure.
And it's like a Marx Brothers thing. You guys are hiding in barrels.
Yeah.
And he's the cop on the beat. I'm going to show it to Gilbert. And they're, where are those rascals? And they pop out of out of barrels. And I guess you guys sing the first single.
Ain't gonna eat up my heart. Yeah, well, you see, Alan and Sid Bernstein were close friends.
I see.
You know, and so you know, people used to help one another in those days. You know what I'm saying? And you know, like, so he helped us. He helped Sid. You know, and you know, we appreciated it. You know, it was a different planet then. You know, it was, of course, it was different. You know,
Alan King was one of the greats.
Funny.
Oh my God, yes, he was. You know, a very smart man, as you well know. You know, he was a brilliant guy. You know.
Oh, and I remember a Buddy Hackett story about Bing Crosby, where he said, "You want to know why Bing Crosby beat his kids? It's because Bing Crosby couldn't get a hide on."
Wow. Yeah, we met him. We met Buddy Hackett at a Ed Sullivan show. We
used to do that show.
Yeah. I loved him, man. Oh my God!
We're gonna
how
ask
funny
you,
can you get? Seriously, how
oh,
funny
was,
can you get?
He was.
You can't get funnier than these people.
Oh,
these guys are brilliant.
Hysterical.
We were gonna ask you about Sullivan, about doing the Sullivan Show. Did you? Because we had Peter Asher here, who did the Sullivan Show. We had Tommy James, and everybody remembers him as kind of stiff, kind of humorless.
He hated us.
He hated you.
So Ed Sullivan hated the Rascals.
You know, man. You know.
How so, Felix?
Well, you know, how can I put this nicely? I can't.
Don't.
You know, he was not a nice guy. You know what I'm saying?
We've heard that too. You know,
and we were very high at those days. So I don't know. I guess you could say he didn't like looking up to people. I don't know. What can I tell you? He didn't like us because, you know, we were pretty stoned when I walked in that door. He looked at me like, "Get back under that rock, you son of a," you know.
Ed Sullivan struck me as a prick, even back then.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, his son-in-law, who was the director of the show, is named Bob Precht.
Yeah.
So it was pretty close.
I see. Well, we'd heard he could be vengeful and wield his power in aggressive ways, Ed Sullivan.
Yeah, I had a couple of run-ins, you know, with him over the years because we did it 6 times.
Right.
You know? So I asked him for a locker. I said, "Can we have a permanency here?" You know. Oh well.
Well, Gilbert also wants to know if you have any recollection of doing the Joey Bishop show.
Oh yes.
Oh, absolutely, I do. Sure, I do. And I'll tell you why. Because of Sammy Davis Jr. Because, you know, in those days, the Beatles had done these two videos, you know, films, "Strawberry Fields" and "Penny Lane."
Oh, Penny Lane. Yeah.
Yes.
So we started a company, true story, called Pasta Productions.
Danelli, Brigati, and Cavalieri.
Thank you very much.
Right.
And we did a video down in, down in Puerto Rico, of all places. And he wouldn't let us put it on the air, you know, because he said, "Look, I paid for live music. You guys are playing," you know. But Sammy got us permission to show that video on the show. And you know, like I had never met Sammy Davis Jr., but what a nice man. You know what I'm saying? He didn't have to do that. You know, he just came to our aid.
That's nice.
What was Joey Bishop like?
He was kind of like, he was kind of like a little dry, you know, off the air and funny as hell on the air. You know what I'm saying? He's one of that those personalities like you guys have, you know, you're one guy, and when you're not on, you're a pain in the ass, you know. But I liked him because he was nice to us, you know. He was a gentleman to us, and you know, when you're a kid, you appreciate that, you know. You're nice to us, you know. We liked it. We liked him.
We heard some negative stories about Joey Bishop from several people. Glad you had a good run in with him.
Well, I'm sure, you know, I mean, like I say, you know, in this business, if you don't have negative stories, you've probably been in it a week, you know. That's about it, you know. There's always somebody, right?
Tell us, changing gears about as far as you can get from Joey Bishop, tell us about the great Laura Nero, who you worked with, who was a genius and left us too soon.
Well, I happened to meet David Geffen before he was David Geffen.
Uh-huh.
He was at
You met a lot of people before they were who they were.
I know. That shows you the years that go by. But he was an agent at that time, and he was also her manager. And so he said, and this is a true story. He says, how would you like to meet the most impossible person you ever met? And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, we need a producer for Laura Nero. She's a big fan. What do you think? Well, she and I became like, you know, dear, dear friends. I adored her. You know what I'm saying? And
what a songwriter.
And just a phenomenal talent. And one of the strangest people I've ever met as far as the purest artist I've ever met. I never met anybody whose music, you know, really meant that much. Because a lot of us, you know, with all due respect, you know, they say, well, you know, they're not going to play it in the radio like that. You know, so you change it. She would not change it.
Yeah, you know, I found that interesting. You said that she was inflexible that way. She really knew what she wanted, and that was that.
That was that.
Gilbert, you know those songs, Stony End, Sweet Blindness, and Wedding Bell Blues.
Oh, yes.
She was a genius.
And unknown, a lot of people don't know who she is.
Yeah. Sadly.
And one group we mentioned before that we had two members of on the podcast, the Monkees. You worked with.
Yeah.
Did you guys do a Monkees episode that was unreleased?
No.
Or something like that?
Don't blame that on us. We didn't do that.
I got to check my research on that.
I just work with those guys. I just work with Mickey and Mike. And, you know, I know, and we knew, what's his name, Davey Jones for years. Mm-hmm. He, you know, who was a really funny guy. I don't know if you guys know that.
I met him once.
He was really a really good comedian. I mean, he had a really good wit.
Great Davey Jones trivia is, of course, he appeared on The Sullivan Show the night the Beatles made their debut in 64. Wow. He was in a stage production of Oliver in the UK. Did you know that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he's on that episode. And so was Frank Gorshin, by the way.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I also want to I have to talk a little bit about it, and it's an overused term, Felix, blue-eyed soul.
Yes.
But I have to, and in doing the research, there's a clip of you guys on the Tom Jones Show.
Oh yeah,
You and Tom Jones duetting in the Midnight Hour.
That's great,
which is friggin' fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Yeah, we were in England, and here it was about 10 a.m. in the morning, and he's completely drunk. Yeah, and man,
at
we
10
just,
a.m.
We just at 10 a.m.
Well,
yeah. But I tell you, he was and is. He's good, man.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So we worked off each other. That was fun. I remember that. I saw that clip many times. That was fun.
And we heard that Tom Jones was also a fun guy to work with.
Well, I always had a lot of respect to Tom, and I'll tell you why. You know, he came to a club that we were working in as the Rascals, you know? And I'm dating this really nice-looking blonde, you know? And he's like this humongous, like, sex idol, you know?
Uh-huh.
He comes in, asks her to dance. I says, so long. That's it. Goodbye. But when he heard that she was my girlfriend, he left her alone.
Class.
Oh, wow.
So I said, a mensch and a half there. So, you know, I always had a tremendous fondness with this guy.
Yes, just to quote Billy Saluga, he was quite the coxman. What he said about Tom Jones.
Yep.
Tom Jones, I once heard a recording of him singing My Yiddish Mama.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
The other thing Gilbert and I were talking about, too, because he brought up Murray the K, and it's interesting, too. One of the fun stories is you writing Groovin'.
Yeah.
Because you also had Latin influences.
Right.
And what happened? What was Jerry Wexler's reaction?
Well, the record company did not like it because there was no drums in it. Right. You know, it was a conga rather than drums, and so they were very concerned about us, you know, kind of leaving our so-called rock and roll roots, you know. But mm-hmm. Murray was in the studio at that time. And he went into Jerry and said, I'll put that record on the air tomorrow, you know. And he did. And that was number one for 6 weeks.
Number one.
Yeah.
Groovy on a Sunday afternoon. Really couldn't get away too soon. I can't imagine anything that's better. The world is ours whenever we're together. There ain't a place I like to be. Down a crowded avenue, Juliet, anything we like to do. There's always lots of things that we can see. We can be anyone we like to be.
It's interesting how record executives survive.
Well, I've heard you say. I mean, they're right sometimes, and they're wrong a lot of times.
Like everybody else. However, right. You know, when you got the power, you know, you got the power, and that's the end of. I mean, like, imagine the guy, and he's legendary. The guy who passed on the Beatles.
You know, oh, yes.
I mean, he's he'll go down in history, biggest schmuck in the world, right? But he did. They passed. Ah, we don't want you guys. You're not good. You'll never mean anything.
And yep. How did People Gotta Be Free come about?
Well, you know, again, I was working for Bobby Kennedy's campaign, you know, and I was with this lady who actually was there at the assassination. You know, she was present.
That's incredible. She was at the Ambassador.
She was at the Ambassador in L.A.
Wow.
And I was on vacation, and I heard about it, man. I said, we gotta say something, man. We got to do something, you know, because, you know, in those days, a lot of us, you know, were really involved. You know, we were involved in what we thought was saving the world, you know, cosmic consciousness, civil rights. We were involved. Whereas today, these people are afraid to tell you what they think because they're going to lose their audience. You know what I mean? So they're real brave guys out there today, you know? Because if you look at the campaigns, the only guys that are out there, they're older, you know?
Yeah.
They're afraid now. They're afraid of saying what they're about. Well, we weren't.
Well, the Rascals were known for not playing gigs that weren't integrated.
Yeah. I mean, you know, little did I know the trouble was causing by saying that. You know, I thought I had a good idea. You know, what a great idea. Oh, yeah, that'll go over big down here.
Well...
You know, you got to think, my man, you know.
Was there, and if you're uncomfortable talking about this, Felix, I'll just cut it out of the show because we're not live. Was there an incident in Florida that And I haven't heard you speak about it. I did a little digging that partly inspired People Gotta Be Free.
No, it just partly inspired me taking up martial arts.
Oh, okay.
Oh, jeez.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, long hair in the South, you know, in the 60s. And
You ran into some trouble.
Well, you know, it was Dino's fault, you know. He said, let's stop there. You know, let's eat over there, you know. Oh, boy.
Now, the Bobby Kennedy assassination, didn't that drive Bobby Darin nutty for a while?
I don't know.
Well, he was close to him, and yeah, a lot of people. John Frankenheimer was a friend of his, and was working with that campaign.
Now, there's a new book out right now that you know I'm reading right now. I mean, who knows what would have happened if he had, you know, made it a little further into the history of the United States? He certainly had some good ideas, that's for sure.
Well, that song went to number one, but it was big in Hong Kong. It was big in South Africa. I mean, that song was really embraced.
Yes, and it's something I've always been proud of, you know, because, like, you know, when they knocked the Berlin Wall down, they played People Gotta Be Free. Yes, indeed.
That had to feel great.
Yeah, that does feel great. It really does.
And Springsteen said to you that the song would never be surpassed in terms of...
Well,
and that had to feel good, too.
Yeah, we had a couple of meetings way back, you know, in the beginning, and you know, he told me that, you know, he really felt, you know, the truth of those words, you know, spoke, you know, to him.
Did it change you, Felix? The assassination. I mean, you were working for the campaign. Obviously, you describe you guys what you guys were. Well, you were idealistic.
Yeah. It didn't change any of my. No, it didn't.
I don't mean it didn't change your politics.
No, it didn't change at all.
No.
No, it just you know, like, you know, everybody, you know, it's like, you know, when we were at Atlantic, you know, when Martin Luther King was assassinated. Now, mm-hmm. Atlantic was an all black label. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and everybody said, well, were you guys all right? Everybody was crying. How could we not be all right? You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, there was no anger there, danger there of us. You know, everybody was sad. Everybody was crying. They lost their guy. They lost their, you know, their father figure, their, you know, their you know, the guy who they thought was going to bring. It was a different world then.
Sure.
You know? Now, boy, your God, you know, it's something else now, isn't it? Yeah.
And so the Rascals eventually went their separate ways. You did.
Yes.
You did a lot of solo work. You worked with Todd Rundgren. You worked with all kinds of people. And then, well, there was a reunion tour, a brief reunion tour without Eddie in the 80s?
Yep.
In 88?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. That's also when Atlantic did its 40-year anniversary.
Right. You did that show, too.
Oh, that was so much fun. Yeah. All of the acts came, you know, together. And we were all pretty much at the same hotel, so it was, like, really, really nice.
Is that show available, by the way, that Atlantic 40th anniversary?
I think it is. You know, yeah. There was a little kind of, like, funny business going on with some of the royalties, so it may not be still available. But, yeah.
Right.
That was a great show, by the way. You know, Zeppelin and everybody else, Bee Gees, man, you name it, they were all there. That was fun.
And then you guys did the cancer benefit in 2010.
Right.
At the Tribeca Grill. And I've heard you say some fence mending took place at that point. People have to understand it's a lot of long, you know, relationships here that are going back, what, 30, 40 years with you guys.
Yeah, you know,
like a family.
Just, it's real silly. You know, it's silly. I mean, you know, like I say, to break up when you're on top of the, you know, top of the pile there, man, is just the stupidest thing, you know, we've ever done. And we've done a lot of stupid things since then, let me tell you.
What was happening when you were on top and, like, between all of you?
Oh, God, that's a tough question there. You know, because, I think if the more groups you talk to, you'll probably hear the same story.
Well, Howard told us a similar story about the Turtles.
Over and over and over, you know. There was really no reason, concrete reason, for any of that to happen. And by that, I mean, there was nobody like stealing, you know, embezzling, stealing each other's wives. You know, there was nothing. It was just, you can only say the word ego, jealousy, stupidity. And I do mean that with a capital S, stupidity. You don't break up a winning team, man. You know? So it was real sad. That affected me very much, you know, because
I'm sure,
you know, you put this dream together and then all of a sudden, you know, like, one of the guys decides to leave. It's like your car. All of a sudden, they, you know, the front wheel says, screw this, I'm going. You know? And it leaves, you know?
Well, tell us about a better memory. Tell us about getting inducted into the Hall of Fame and little Steven inducting you guys. And I didn't know when I was telling Gilbert that when he made the induction speech that led to him being cast in The Sopranos, which is great trivia.
It's great trivia.
Yeah.
And have you seen his little bit there?
I watched it yesterday. I can see what David Chase saw in him.
He told me he had another half hour and he was too embarrassed to do it. He really,
well,
really
he takes off the coat. He's wearing a big, heavy coat.
Phenomenal.
And the schmata.
Yeah.
And then he takes he takes the coat off and he's wearing the old Rascals little Lord Fauntleroy with a little tiny tie.
That was really good.
Really great. You didn't see that coming, did you? He surprised you too?
No, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did it feel? I mean, you know, give us some perspective.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the Rascals is kind of like, it's like saying Suris. You know what I mean? There's seriously. Yeah. I mean, your audience will know what I mean. Yeah. You know, like, it's never like, you know, like, boy, that's great. No, no. It's aggravation from, you know, You don't have a dull moment. There's never a dull moment because there's always somebody making, you know, trouble. You know what I'm saying? Otherwise, it was a great night.
Yeah.
You know, Eddie came on. He looked like an Apache. Yeah. You know, at that time, he was in Indian garb, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you saw his speech, but.
I saw the whole thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All you have to do is listen to that and you say, like, why?
Yeah.
You know, why? I took it very seriously, you know. I took it very seriously, you know, and I felt like, okay, this is cool. And, you know, not only that, but I got a chance to see people. It was the last time I got to see a lot of these people because they passed, like, you know, from the Bee Gees.
Robin and Maurice.
Maurice was gone shortly after. Michael from the Jackson 5, you know, so it was a big thing for me to, you know, kind of see these guys, you know, like, you know. It was fun. I say that word fun because, look, man, I've had a ball. I enjoy everything I do, let me tell you. So I don't look back at the aggravation. But unfortunately, it was a lot of it, you know, with us.
Right. Well, do you allow yourself those moments like, you know, I'm the kid from Westchester and I idolize these guys and now I'm in the Hall of Fame with Elvis and Chuck Berry and the Beatles. And
But it still cost me to get on the subway. What am I going to tell you? Same price. So there you go. You know, it's the same price.
You got real perspective, Felix.
You got that right. Do you know who I am? Yeah. $2.50, please. Absolutely. Yeah.
By the way, some of those B-sides, like What Is the Reason and Love Is a Beautiful Thing, I thought those could have been hits, too. I'm surprised they weren't released as singles.
Okay, I got a good story for you.
Go ahead.
Because I know it's getting late. So
No. We're not on a time.
And I do this in my show because this is correct. You know, we didn't know anything about business. You know, today the people come into they have a little bit of knowledge. You know, so we didn't know that the front side, the back side of a 45 sells exactly the same amount of records as the front side. We didn't know that. So years go by, and I'm in a club in New York, and we're doing one of those sing-around things, you know? And this guy comes up to me and gives me this huge Bugs Bunny-type kiss, you know? And I said, what's that, man? He says, man, you have no idea. You changed my life. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you put my song on the other side of Good Lovin'. He says, man, I made so much money, you can't believe it. He made money, then Wilson Pickett heard it. It was Mustang Sally.
Wow.
Oh, jeez. Yes.
Yeah. So we learned, put your song on the other side. Got it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I liked your solo album, too, your first solo album with Rundgren, The High Price to Pay, and very good stuff.
Thank you. Well, you know, I just enjoy making music, man, you know, and all the years, you know, it's difficult, you know, to leave a group that was successful and go on your own, you know. But
of course.
That's the story. That's what happens, you know?
What about touring with Ringo and the All-Star Band and working with Billy Preston? Got memories?
Yeah, you know, it was an experience, you know. Of course, it was John Entwistle.
John Entwistle, yes.
Yeah, John,
yes.
You know, and we had Mark Farner and Randy Bachman.
Right.
And
Mark Farner from Grand Funk.
Yeah.
Right.
That's an interesting concept because, you know, Ringo, like, you know, he's such an interesting guy because, you know, he's just a big ham, you know what I mean? I mean, he needs money, right? He needs to go on stage, you know what I'm saying?
He was just here at the Beacon last week with the All-Star, you know, with the All-Star Band. He's still doing it.
You got to pull him off, you know, pull him off the stage.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting, you know, because, you know, like when you're in the dressing room with a Beatle, you know, and everybody's like, you know, pretending they're not in the conversation. Then all of a sudden somebody asks him a question, you know? And everybody turns around. They want to see what he's going to answer, you know? You know, like they asked him one night, they said, hey, Ringo, how come you had your drum, your stool up so high? And then everybody turned around and said, well, they got to see me, right? You know, really, really good guy, man. You know, like, but, you know, he can't go anyplace. You know, when he used to try to go out, like if we had a day off, he'd have to have the whole theater for the movies to go in there. They'd open the place up just for him.
That's amazing. Even now.
Even now.
Man in his 70s.
The Beatles could only talk amongst themselves to know what it's like, what their life is.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
Yeah, although I'm sure like Bruce has got the same thing going on and, you know, maybe Billy and, you know, you too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certain, you know, people in that echelon that, you know, that's a different level.
Saw you doing, saw you at the Garden with Billy too. That was a treat.
Yeah. Well, he's an old friend, you know.
I know you guys go way back.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Boy, can you imagine? He's going to do his 50th show there, sell out.
Amazing. Yeah.
That's insane. Right.
Yeah. So tell us, so you're in Nashville now.
Right.
You're still touring. I know you're coming here.
Yep.
We didn't coordinate this. We like to have you here in person.
You know, I could have done it next week, but, you know, I didn't really know I was coming. I would take a couple of days off, you know, but this is fun.
We'll come back next week.
I love talking to you guys. You guys are great.
You don't have your keyboard with you, do you?
I do, but it's not activated, as they say.
Oh, okay. Too bad. Well, the next time we're going to make you play.
Okay, that's a deal.
And we have to do a duet of Rascal songs.
Yeah, not the mouse, though. We can't do the mouse.
Well, you know, Felix, he sang Moni Moni with Tommy. He sang Sugar Sugar with Ron Dante. The man sitting next to me.
MacArthur Park.
He sang MacArthur Park with Jimmy.
All right.
Tie a Yellow
He sang with Tony Orlando. Who else?
Okay.
So he sang The Rainbow Connection with Paul Williams.
That's right.
Okay. I'm in.
Okay.
See, you should be honored to be singing.
It could be worse. Absolutely. I'll be there.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. So, and by the way, the other the album you did with Steve Cropper, the Nudge It Up a Notch, great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Great stuff. That. I want our listeners to find that another brilliant musician, Steve Cropper. And tell us what's going on. Tell us about the website. Tell us about the tour. You're coming here. You're going to be on Long Island. You're going to be in Massachusetts. You're going to be in Connecticut. It's on your website.
Well, you know, I still enjoy what I do. You know, and basically, I'm excited about next year. I'm going to be with the Nashville Symphony. I'm doing my music with the symphony here. It's going to be a real treat. I'm looking forward to that.
Great.
That's something I've been wanting to. It's kind of full circle from when I started with classical. And I'm doing a book. You know, I'm trying to finish the book.
I was just going to say Howard wrote a very funny book, Howard Kalin, and you got to have a book in you.
Yeah. Well, Howard's a funny man. He's you know, he's a screenwriter. If I'm not mistaken,
he's a DJ. He's everything.
But you know how long I know those guys? I mean, it's unbelievable.
Howard and
how
Mark.
Old I am. I mean, seriously, I remember them. Oh God, way back. My God, you know, which is cool, you know. And now, you know, he's a Mark Vollman's a professor here at one of the universities.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's how low we've gotten in this country.
leave us with one thing. Any memories of doing a Tonight Show with Janis Joplin? Santana and Phil Spector.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I've got a lot of memories of that. And I was just thinking, I think the hosts were Steve and Edie Gourmet.
I believe they were.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, I remember Janis was very, she smelled of liquor a lot. You know, there was a lot of liquor in the room. You know? Yeah. And Phil, I've been a huge fan of Phil Spector all my life. You know, I just feel so badly about, you know, the karma that has befallen him, because what a genius. There's another genius. You know, we don't have too many geniuses, but, you know, he was one of them.
Now, was Phil a nut when you knew him? I mean, he was just brilliant.
Well, he's carrying a gun into the studio.
Oh, God. No, he was a strange man. You know, he was a very strange man. He used to hang around with, oh, come on, now, you guys got to help me. Who's that comedian that way in the old days got in such trouble with the bad words?
Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, he was very, very close with Lenny Bruce.
Ah,
I didn't know that.
Period of time when he was going through all the court cases and everything. Yeah. So they were two crazies, right? You know, but yeah, Phil was always, you know, he's just very different, man. You know, he was not like, you know, like most people you would meet. You know, but he was so talented. Oh my God!
Yeah. What about Bobby Darin?
You didn't really get to know Bobby Darin. Bobby Darin was like a little cocky guy. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he kind of didn't really, you know, socialize, you know, that much with guys with long hair.
Oh, really? You were the You were the long-haired hippie freaks.
Yeah, he was like, exactly. He was a Sinatra, you know, he was in that world there, you know. But he was there. He was always nice, but he was not like a, you know, he didn't come out and talk to you, you know.
You know, one thing that's refreshing, Felix, and we'll let you go, is that I saw a lot of interviews with you, read a lot of interviews with you, and you're humble because you said luck has played a role in everything.
Who knows? You know what I mean? Like, you asked before, did I think I was going to be a musician? I didn't think anything. You know, I'm just very happy to be here, folks. You know what I'm saying? Because I've had a great career. I've had a lot of fun. I got a great family, a healthy body, and no money. So where did I go wrong? What can I say?
Felix, you promise you next time you see us, you'll play and sing with Gilbert.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Hey, thank you so much, guys. I really enjoyed it. You know, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the music, my friend.
Thank you.
It's our honor. We wanted you. We started this thing, what, 180 shows ago?
Oh, my God.
You've been on our list, and we said to Jackie, get Felix.
Thank you, man. Happy holidays to you all. And I will. I'll make sure we get together. We owe ourselves a duet here.
Happy belated birthday, by the way.
All right, my friend. Thank you. God bless.
And we want to thank Jackie Martling, too, for setting this up and for bringing you into the fold.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we'll see you again.
All right. Take care.
I'm Gilbert Gottfried. I'm here with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. And this has been another edition of Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. And today we've been talking to a guy who's a guinea, but he knows a lot of chew words.
You might say that.
So, in that case, he's okay with me. Felix Cavallari.
Well, thank you. Mazel tov, my friends. See you.
Thanks, Felix.
See you, guys.
Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast is produced by Dara Gottfried and Frank Santopadre, with audio production by Frank Verderosa. Web and social media is handled by Mike McPadden, Greg Pear, and John Bradley Seals. Special audio contributions by John Beach. Special thanks to Paul Rayburn, John Murray, John Fotiatis, and Nutmeg Creative. Especially Sam Giovanco and Daniel Farrell for their assistance.
Coming right on.